Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at cento.com, Colavita at colavita.com, and Wines of Portugal at winesofportugal.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey everybody, Mike Colomeco here, back from traveling a lot this past couple of months. We're back live, so you're listening to Food Talk here on the Heritage Radio Network. I've got a couple of guests today. We're going to, in a couple of minutes, talk to Beth Shapiro, who's one of the big players behind City Meals on Wheels. It's having their annual gala in another week at Rock Center. So we're going to talk about that, what they do, the great work that they do. And then after Beth and I are done talking, we're going to take a quick break and come back with one of the great psalms here in New York City, recent inductee as a master psalm, not so recent, a year ago, Pascaline Lapeltier. I've had her on the show before. She's great. She's super passionate. I'm stoked to have her. Every time I drink a glass of wine that's good, I think, I wish Pascaline were here so I could talk to her about it. But I can do that today. And I wanted to give a shout out to a restaurant. You know, so I've been traveling. So I'm just back. We were in Alsace, France, filming for, I don't know, 9 or 10 days on the food and wine culture. Emphasis on wine for sure. It's an area that I've always loved. It's an area that gets confused, I think, a lot in some people's minds, and when wine drinkers, wines be called, and for good reason. You know, it had been after the 30-year war with whatever, it became France, and then in the late 1800s, for about 30-some years, it was annexed and became part of Germany, was returned to France again in the early part of the 1900s. And the confusion is just that. Is it France? Is it Germany? And all, and to add to that, the bottles are sort of tall and slope-shouldered and green and look very Germanic, as do the varietals, like Riesling and Gewürztraminer and Silvaner and on and on. But it's a totally different style of winemaking in a way. The Rieslings from Alsace are completely bone dry, tend to be a little higher alcohol. And it was great, great. It was delicious. We drank so much good wine. I couldn't have had more fun with the people I was with. So big shout out to everybody in Alsace and to a restaurant that I finally got to. They've been open a year, and I've been trying to get to them, which is crazy because they're just a few blocks from my house. My apartment, I mean, in New York City, and it's called Fung 2. Have you been here? Yeah, it's really, it's kind of open. It's funny because it just got reviewed. Congratulations, guys. 2 stars, which is always a great review because it was really positive. And in the review, Wells sort of talked about the evolution of the restaurant from his early visits to the later visits. And that's always true. It's why I really don't like to go to restaurants until they've been around for 6 months to a year and they've had a chance to get their sea legs under them and sort of go through that whole what works and what doesn't work, what the kitchen can do and can't do process. But anyway, I was there for the first time last night, and I have to tell you, I can't wait to go back. It's great. It's, I think, Orchard, just south of Delancey, 2 blocks, in that kind of cool new neighborhood that's reinventing itself. Couple of blocks from Mission Chinese, which I know do not need to hype, because I came back from France Saturday night, and I was starving. My apartment was a million degrees because I didn't have the AC on. So I came back, dropped my suitcase off, showered, turned the AC on, said, I got to get out of here. I need to eat something. And I said, oh, I'll go to Mission. It's midnight. I can get in. Really? What was I thinking? So I got on my bicycle. It's literally 2 minutes from my apartment on East Broadway. East Broadway. And as I'm approaching it, I'm thinking, what the F is, why are there so many people hanging around outside? Maybe there was like a wedding that just, no. There was 50 people waiting in line at midnight to get in to Mission Chinese. Yeah. So I went to Chinatown, which was mysteriously quiet. I don't know why that is. Maybe Chinatown's changed from, when I was a kid, Chinatown stayed open late, but I was there, and lots of places were closed, so I had to go to those old standbys like Hop Key and Wo Hop, those little ones on Mott, and I did. And then I biked back past Mission Chinese again at like 1, and there was still 50 people outside. So, geez, Danny. All right. I guess he's doing it. All right. Let's go to my first guest. I think we have her on the phone. Beth, are you there?
I am on the phone, and I'm getting hungry listening to you.
Sorry about that. Have you managed to get down to Fung Tu? Have you heard of the place yet?
I've heard of it, and I have not been down there, but now I must.
Yeah, so. It's really good. I mean, the chef, so it's one of these typical, like, could have been in Brooklyn kind of things. It's young. Well, everything at this point. At this point, the whole world's young to me. But no, the chef had worked for years at Per Se. I remember him from the kitchen there. So, you know, when you're in that kitchen, when you're in Thomas Keller's kitchens under Jonathan Benno and Thomas Free, you've got chops. That's a given. And he's kind of playing around with, like, reinventing Asian cooking through a modern lens. The front of the house guy, whose name escapes me, I'm terrible with names, also did the wine list. Wine list was really good. We had so many good pairings. But anyway, let's talk about what you do. So, City Meals on Wheels. When is the gala? Is it a week? Is it next weekend?
It is Monday in, what, 5 days?
Wow.
Monday, June 8th, evening at Rockefeller Center. We're psyched.
Are there still tickets available?
There are VIP tickets available. We've sold out of our young professional and our lower level tickets. I was just actually preparing an email for our co-chairs. We're at 1,212 guests.
Congratulations.
It's exciting, very exciting. It's our 30th anniversary year, and it is a perfect time to sort of, you know, celebrate with a great group of people and absolutely amazing chefs.
On the way over here today, I bicycle around town, weather permitting, and I live on the Lower East Side, and I was bicycling past one of your trucks from the settlement, Henry Street.
Yeah.
So you guys are everywhere. Let's just roll back the clock a bit,
sure.
Because it's a really great story. So we go back to 1981, November. I had yet to come to New York. I arrived in January of 82. But in any way, Gail Green, who was at the time the food critic of record for New York Magazine, just got this great idea in her head. I don't know where it came from, about the idea that restaurants have excess food on a nightly basis, and there are New Yorkers by the boatload who could use calories on a nightly basis.
Something like that, yes. She, and I was not yet in New York either, she read an article in the New York Times about older people going without food for up to 4 days. The city has a Meals on Wheels program then and now, delivers meals Monday through Friday. Homebound elderly, you know, people who are too frail to shop and cook for themselves. She read the article in the Sunday Times, and in her words, as is true, she was living a life of delicious excess.
Yeah.
As only Gail could say.
Yeah.
And she was horrified that right down the street from her, older women and men weren't eating. So she called James Beard, amazing chef and cookbook author. And together that weekend, they raised $35,000 and six chickens. They called the city, the Department for the Aging, Gail did, on, I guess, Monday or Tuesday the following week, and said, we're going to do Christmas, because the article was talking about Thanksgiving, because the city closed Thursday, Friday for the holiday, and then the weekend, and these people were going to go 4 days without food, which was horrible. So she called and she said, we're going to do Christmas, and we're going to feed the same 6,000 people a Christmas meal. That was November 1981, feeding 6,000 people. In this past December, Gail delivered our 50 millionth meal. We deliver about 2 million meals a year now to 18,000 older people who built this city. I mean, these are the people who lived in your neighborhood, my neighborhood, all across the city, and are just too old at this point, too frail to shop or cook for themselves. More and more, you know, 80s, 90s. We even have 200 people who are 100 years old or older.
Yeah, and they are this sort of invisible New York, right? Because New York is the city of youth and beauty and speed and fashion and, right, my idea of a bad night's going out to dinner and, you know, not liking the wines paired with my tasting menu or something just horribly white people-ish. And yet, I live in Co-op Village downtown, which had been for years. I mean, it was the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union is one that built it. And in my complex, there are people that are really, really old, and I see them all the time on my floor, in the elevators. I don't know if they get outside much. A winter like this was an incredibly bad winter for them. I mean, it was bad for us. They're like, you know, that can move around, that have legs that work, and have clothes and cab fare. Mm-hmm. I cannot imagine. So Talk about what Meals on Wheels does on a day-to-day basis. How do you network the restaurants, the chefs, and the people that you're serving?
Mm-hmm. Well, we work with 30 meal centers around the city to deliver weekday meals. A fresh meal, I hate to say it, but reminiscent of a TV dinner, but much better. And we have to follow federal guidelines for nutrition standards for older people. So there's always protein, veggie, starch, bread, butter, fruit, milk. And then on the weekends, we have, actually not far from where you are right now, in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, we have a warehouse where we do shelf-stable food, boxes of three meals in advance of holiday weekends, Memorial Day, July 4th, coming up, and a huge box in October, November to prepare people for the winter weather, as you talked about. Just from January to April this year, we delivered 95,000 emergency meals. Yes.
The funding for this is coming from where?
Privately funded. We have about a $20 million budget. We do get about $1.8 million from the city, but the rest is general donations from everyday New Yorkers. We guarantee that 100% of every donation from the general population go to meal preparation and delivery. That was Gail's mandate in the beginning, and we live by that. And we have grown with everyday New Yorkers, but also the chef community. You know, based on our roots with Gail and James Beard, the chef and food world have been involved with City Meals from day one. And this event, the 30th anniversary of our Chef's Tribute event, is really all about that. It was originally a birthday party for James Beard. And Larry Forgione and Jonathan Waxman had this great idea to have a barbecue birthday party for him with his
Way back when Waxman had jams and Larry was at River Cafe.
And everybody had hair.
Yeah, right, right.
Yes, way back when. And unfortunately, James passed away several months beforehand, but they all agreed he loved good food and a good party, and it should go on anyway in his honor. And there were 12 original chefs, sort of his disciples, and we've grown to, you know, raise nearly $20 million from this event alone year after year. We're going to have over 40 chefs in Rock Center. As I said, over 1,200 guests. We are grateful that they give us this space that is magical in the middle of New York, to me, the middle of the world.
Yeah, I have to agree. That plaza has grown on me over the years to the point where, I mean, forgetting, you know, Christmas with the tree and the ice rink, but it's just one of the most magic spaces in the city. It's beautiful. There's just symmetry there. There's energy there. It's gorgeous. So people listening here, the VIP tickets are super expensive, but if people are listening and they want to just simply donate, which is a great thing to do, how do they do that and where do they go? What's the website?
Absolutely. Website is citymeals.org, CITYMEALS.org. If you want to go straight to the event page, /Cheftopia. And there are tickets still available. Again, 100% of ticket sales go to meal preparation and delivery. So it's a great tax benefit and a really great night to do good and eat like never before. Danielle Ballou, Jean George, Alfred Portali, of course Larry and Mark Forgione, as well as Jonathan Waxman, and many, many more.
Yeah. No, I saw that. You got. It's not just New York. You've got Matt Acarino coming from the West Coast. There's chefs coming in from all around the country, really big guns, really top names. It's got to be tons of fun. Website one more time.
citymeals.org, CITYMEALS.org.
That's so if people want to go, and it's the Monday, is it next? What day?
It's this month.
This coming Monday.
Today's Thursday. This coming Monday, VIP admission at 6:30, general admission 7:30. We would love to see you.
Congratulations for what you're doing. Congratulations on selling out the event, except for this, the most precious thing. It's great that people are supporting it like that. And keep up the great work. We really love what you guys do. You know, you're serving a population of New York that's basically invisible.
Yeah.
But we know they're there, like you said. I mean, whatever neighborhood you're in, they're there. Our U.S. government doesn't really step in to do this stuff. So if it wasn't for the beneficence of Gail and people like you and the organization and the chefs and the wherewithal to make it happen, I don't even want to think about the outcome. So thanks so much for what you do.
Mike, thank you so much for having us and for giving us the opportunity to talk.
Pleasure, pleasure. I know we were out here last year with Alfred.
Yes.
The two of you. It was great. I miss you. Maybe we'll try that next year.
Perfect.
Great. Keep up the great work. So, again, that's City Meals on Wheels. The event is next Monday. It's great. If you've never been, it's amazing. I mean, John George is there. Danielle is there behind his little stand. Alfred will be there. Tons of great chefs. I think Jonathan Waxman is being honored this year. Anyway, all the big guns. It's a great event. Great for the city. Great cause. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'm going to be back. And if you are into wine in any which way, stay tuned, because I've got one of the great educational resources sitting across the table from me, Master Sam. I like the sound of that. Pascaline Lepeltier. We'll be back with her in just a couple of minutes. Don't touch the dial. You're going to learn about wine, not from listening to me, but from listening to my stupid questions and her good answers. Stay tuned for that. So if you want to make a great tomato sauce, where do you start? You start with great canned tomatoes. And what are the best? What's the gold standard? What do the best Italian restaurants use, you think? San Marzano tomatoes from southern Italy. You know, I've heard of San Marzano tomatoes, loved them, heard the whole legend thing, knew they were delicious, but I wanted to go visit the region. So sometime back, I don't know, 06, 07, we went to San Marzano in the middle of the packing season in August. They've got a really long growing season. Starts early spring, April, May, and runs all the way through October because the weather down there is beautiful. You're along the coastline of Naples there in the shadows of Mount Vesuvius. And these are really small family farms, really small, like a half an acre apiece. And that's how they make a living, is harvesting these tomatoes. But what makes them great is the typicity of everything, the style of the tomato. It's kind of a long tomato with a really thin skin, super fleshy, super sweet tasting off the vine. We can Cento San Marzano tomatoes in the prime of the season, which is August. They just slow production down, hand pick everything. Those little basil leaves, yeah, they're all put in there by hand as well. It is the best canned tomato I've ever had, and you're going to love them too. There's a reason chefs love these things. They're San Marzano authorized from the beginning. The factory gets inspected every year. Hey, you want to make great tomato sauce at home? Start with great tomatoes. Cento San Marzano. That's what I use. Hey, folks, Mike Calameco here. Years back when I had my own restaurant, I had to figure out what kind of oils to use, you know, try to make money in the restaurant business. So, you know, the most expensive oil wasn't the choice, but I had to use an oil that was great, an oil that I would use at home and also for my customers. Came upon Colavita olive oil, which to this day still stands head and shoulders above everybody in that extra virgin category in the supermarket shelves. So much of the extra virgin category is dominated by labels that sound like they're Italian. You know, they end with an O or something like that. But the truth is they're tank farm blends that come out of Italy, but what's in the jar or the can is oils from all over the world that are just spot on price. It's commodity oils. Colavita is the only one that's an extra virgin that's 100% Italian origin traceable. It's a great company. They really built their brand on the U.S. market. They get the U.S. market. So if you're looking for a super extra virgin olive oil, use the one that I've been using for years on my table at home and in my restaurants wherever I was hanging my chef's toque, and that would be Colavita Extra Virgin. True Italian, great oil. So my first trip to Portugal was 2013. It was a wine trip. A bunch of us flew over and toured the country top to bottom. Fell in love with the place. The food, the wine, the scenery, everything. Had to come back, which I did in 14 to film. And this time, 8 days in country, top to bottom again. Food, wine, surfing, what's not to love? If you've never been to Portugal, it's an extraordinary place. Buffered on one side by the Atlantic Ocean, you've got great seafood, great wines growing in all those regions. You go a little inland, you've got more great food, incredible wine country. Of course, port is the birthplace of Port Sampdoro. My takeaway was, I thought I'd had a lot of varietals. Like, I keep a list of 130, 135 varietals I've had over my life. Portugal has 250 of its own indigenous wine varietals, and they're killer good. A lot of them are growing there for centuries. It has some of the oldest viticulture in Europe. The sparkling wines from the Bijada, the great reds coming down south from those regions. What's not to love? Crisp whites, beautiful full-bodied reds, port wine, sparkling wine. So if you're not familiar with the wines of Portugal, next time you stop by at your local wine store, ask about them. I love them. I'm drinking a lot of them these days, and I think you will too.
This is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, good. We're back. So, I just got back from a trip. I've been all over. I was in Peru for a while, then I was in Sicily, which was really fun. I'd never been to Sicily before. Really good wine scene. Really interesting wine scene. And then we just got back from Sicily, and of course the food in Sicily was just off the charts, because there's so many influences in that place, man. If you look at where it is, I mean, it's, you can see North Africa from the hillsides. Obviously, you can see the Italian coast, Calabria. The Greeks have been there. The Spanish have been there. The Moors have been there. The French have been there. It's crazy, the influences in Sicily. And then we got back into Sicily, and a week later, we were on a plane to Alsace, France. So in the setup to the show, I was talking about the confusion with Alsace, because it kind of does have a Germanic feel to it. The buildings are very Tudor. The food is kind of bordering, you know. I mean, choucroute garni is one of those funny dishes, you know. It's kind of French, but kind of not. But the wines were great. The wines were really, really fun. So my guest for the rest of the show, without any breaks, is going to be Pascaline Lapeltier. You've probably heard of her. If not, I'll just reintroduce her. Maybe you're a new listener. Maybe you didn't hear the last time she was on. But I first met Pascaline when she was, and she will be again, the sommelier of a really great New York restaurant called Rouge Tomate. Used to be on the corner of 60th and 5th.
Yeah, 60th, between 5th and Madison.
Right, which is by the right around the corner from the Pierre Hotel, steps from Central Park, the heart of the Upper East Side, 10021 zip code. Not a place I spend too much time, but it was worth going there for the food. Now they're moving closer to me, downtown. You'll be on what street?
18 between 6 and 7.
Heart of Chelsea. Bullseye Heart of Chelsea. Yeah. And it's a great restaurant because the concept behind it's kind of interesting. They're kind of sneaky. The restaurant has great food to begin with. So the food's super. But what you don't realize is it's really healthy food. They've removed a lot of fat from the food. Much whole grains instead of processed. It's just really good. It's like, I don't even want to say it's like the best health food you've ever had, but it's kind of, that's the idea. But you'd never know it by eating there. So just go for the food and for Pascaline, because when I first met her, she was on the floor, and she will be again when they reopen. And I've got lots of Somme friends, and among those, she's a legend as well. Got her Master Somme last year, which is great, but what's more important is she's just so passionate and so stoked about the world of wine. So I thought we'd talk about a couple of things. Before we get to Alsace, let's back it up, because I was sitting in the airport in Paris having to kill a day. We flew Colmar to Paris, then I had a long layover in Paris, De Gaulle to New York. So I grabbed a copy of the New York Times International Edition on Saturday, and the front page of that magazine on the bottom below the fold, but the front page, a front page story was by a fellow who I wasn't familiar with, a wine writer named Bruce Schoenfeld, and it was great. It was a really great piece. So it goes from the front, went from page one to page two. Somebody told me it was in the magazine section of last week's Times, which makes sense. But it was a nice long article, and it was all about this sort of divide, and it started out by talking about a sommelier named Raj. You know Raj?
I know Raj very well.
Who's now
the friend, in fact.
Now he's a winemaker. Yeah. And he's talking about, you know, so these two vineyards were literally right next to each other, Raj's vineyard and a vineyard that will remain unnamed that was literally next to his. And Raj is saying, yeah, so I come out here and I'm growing a bunch of different things, but one of them is Pinot Noir. The vineyard that we're standing in is Pinot Noir. And I'm doing kind of a style that's a little contrary to what had been a more traditional California-type wine, New World wine. I harvest it early when the fruit is less ripe, sometimes not quite ripe, not fully ripe. And I am, my juice is fermenting in tanks before the guys next to me even begin their harvest. And then it sort of bore down on this idea of Robert Parker and the hegemonic effect he had really larger than life for much of the 90s and the aughts. The Wine Spectator drove wine sales, changed wine styles. I mean, it was the, he was arguably the most influential wine writer out there.
Yeah, and he educated a lot of people too, you know, like it's was about education of consumer pretty early on.
He was the guy that came
in
up
the 80s,
with the,
you know,
the point system, the idea that you're going to get somewhere between, well, no one got below 70 that I've ever seen, but I guess it's a 100-point scale, but the idea that wines would road like 88, 89, 90, 91, 92, I think he gave it a couple of perfect hundreds from time to time, and those numbers drove wine sales. But his palate was kind of a New World palate. So, Pascaline, talk to me about what's going on in California. Help me understand the California wine scene. You were, you really are sick of it before.
I can do that in 2 weeks when I am back from California.
I know, you're going. You're going.
Yeah, I'm going there.
So we talk about that too. Talk about, I mean, just back it up. Talk about where you're going and why.
Oh, in fact, it's a pretty good one. I'm really lucky, and it's kind of part of the fact that the perspective of the article, I think. I'm very lucky because I'm going to go to Ridge. I'm invited to spend 2 days at Ridge and with Paul Draper and be part of some blending session at Montebello and at the Light and Spring. So I go for that, and I'm psish because I don't know how. First, it's going to be my very first big tasting with Paul Draper, and if there is one winemaker, at least in France, that was known to have shaped a certain quality of wine in California is him. So going and tasting and choosing barrel with him is really going to be something pretty fantastic. And some of the best Californian wine I had, in fact, were in our Ridge from the 70s, the 80s, and 90s. So it's kind of the part of the history of California. So I'm going to spend 2 days with him, and then I'm going to spend some time with a producer I work kind of closely with, and more of this like third generation of growers that are mentioned also in a certain way in the article, that are looking for cooler sites, cooler climate, lower alcohol, higher acid, more natural fermentation, organic biodynamic farming. And I'm going to spend 3 days with them. And also I'm going to do something pretty awesome. I'm going to tour vineyards with Tigan Passalacqua, that is a winemaker for Turley. And Tigan is also part of an association that is about preserving the heritage vineyards of California. So these old vineyards, field blend, planted in the 19th century that has been ripped out little by little and now are reconsidered treasure. And so with Tigan, we are just going to spend a day touring that. So Tigan is at the forefront of this also.
So these are vines that are still productive?
Yeah.
And it's field blend, so nobody knows. They'll have to pull DNA. Nobody knows exactly what was planted.
But some of them are field blend. Some of them are more like have a driven varietal, but like it was like in France, you know, historically, a lot of vineyards were field blend. One of the most like iconic one I was lucky to visit with Tigan and Abe Schoner like last year was the Library Vineyard in the north of Napa, and probably 25-30 different varieties from Charbonneau to Carignan to Monastrell, Mourvèdre, Matarol, how you want to name it, to Zin, some whites, and so on and so on. And they are extraordinary sight, and yes, they are producing. But they are producing probably the grapes that are not that trendy. And it's great that young, extraordinarily talented guys like Tigan, like all the guy at Bedrock, Morgan, Twin Peterson, like just to name him, are just with the help of older, in quotation mark, more historical winemaker, are just like trying to preserve these sites, you know? And so what's happening right now in California is pretty fantastic, and especially with this dialogue between the real historical part of the valley and the extraordinary dynamic of farming and winemaking that's happening right now, you know? I think there is it's very unique and it's pretty fantastic to go and try to see what's happening in Cali right now.
And you talked about, I mean, before we were on air, you were making a great point about, as a culture, America how young we are to wine, and it's so true. I mean, we don't think about it, but so I'm almost 60 now, and when I go back to when I was a kid, I mean, my God, the people just weren't, unless you were really well-heeled and well-traveled, or ethnic. Like, my grandparents drank homemade wine with dinner all the time, but somebody in the neighborhood made it. I have no idea what it was. Kind of reminds me now of some bad Sangiovese or something. But, I mean, but wine drinking in America was just sort of like the elite knew. If you had been to Europe, you knew about Bordeaux and Burgundy. But America was not a culture that was consuming wine in the 60s and 70s. California's kind of just getting started. So it's really just the last 20 years that we've sort of woken up, or maybe 30 now, to the world of wine, and our palates have changed. And talk about, I mean, so you're mentioning like the third generation of California winemakers, and the first ones would maybe we would go back to like the Mondavis of the world, or whom?
Yeah, like, you know, I'm just watching that from outside, and, you know, I'm a young outsider coming from Europe, and just also I just work in New York, so I haven't never worked in a valley in Cali. But yeah, just like when you read or when you taste, there is like the pioneer and the founders that you can probably stretch from 1890 up to the 1980s, and then you get the second kind of generation that were the first to go to UC Davis and
yeah, study
to, and study, really yeah. study, and they had a huge impact, but probably more a technical, number, rational impact on viticulture, where maybe you know it's maybe numbers were more valuable than intuition, just because we are not talking about an area where you could rely on a certain wisdom of generation of growers like you can do in the old right. world, you know, so where a lot of observation and intuition were part of how to make and how to grow. Like, suddenly you're here and you go to school and probably you learn numbers and you learn rules and you learn
facts. So it's pH of the soil, it's brick of the grape, it's ripeness of the grape, it's the technical.
Yeah, where you because this kind of extensive observation in time where probably not you didn't have it. So
correct.
Which tool can you have?
Right.
You have scientific tool and you're
right.
going to use them to
right.
learn where you are growing grapes. So now you rely on that, and then you get probably an excess like in everything else. You know, like intuition can be excessive and rationalization can be excessive. So if you just rely on numbers, maybe at one point, you know, you go wrong on you if you just rely on a certain way of thinking science. And now we are kind of, I just feel like you have guys also going or like even us, like, you know, on the somewhere we are going to school, we are learning a lot of data, but there is just way more discussion, dialogue. They are not even anymore regional, they are international. You can travel the world. You can suddenly be in conversation with people from Greece and Friuli and Burgundy. And you can by this dialogue, start to really understand things that maybe you can apply to where you are. And right now, what's happening is this kind of mix between getting back to a certain respect, intuition, other type of knowledge. And it's it's how I see it. So second generation and now third generation.
And to the benefit of this third generation, the newest generation, the American public palate has changed so much in the last 15, 20 years. I remember talking to Neil Rosenthal, importer, and Neil was a champion of a certain, you know, kind of the, well, let's just, for want of a better term, you know, high-acid wines, and was bringing them in the 90s to restaurants, and chefs, we would drink them, and we loved it. But they'd say, we can't sell these. The American palate wasn't there yet. So I think in the last 15, 20 years, almost in lockstep with, now that we're sort of done with the days of over-oaked, flabby Chardonnays and cabs that are 15.5 alcohol and just these broad-shouldered bullies. And now the American palate really is embracing acidity, minerality, lower alcohol at the same time, no?
Yeah, it's probably also like it's a broader movement also. I think it's probably linked to the food also. You know, the way you are eating food and the way you are drinking is different. It's more, it's maybe less a teenager palate and more a mature palate.
Less teenager, more mature. Yeah.
And so, and when suddenly you kind of appreciate things that are maybe a little less immediately like satisfying. You know, it's not only about sweetness and spice, and you start to discover all the level and layers.
Right.
Like, just I'm here since only 6 years, and like, it's been extraordinary in 6 years, and everything is compressed today. Probably what would have taken 20 years, 50 years ago is not just taking 1 or 2 years. And if you put that we can just travel all around the world pretty easily for a quite decent price. You go abroad to study, families like split off everywhere. You are exposed to tastes that you probably would have not been exposed to if you are just staying in your place. And it goes for wine the same way. And yes, it takes a bit of education, like for everything. You know, you try to, I don't know, eat capers when you're a baby, and it's going to be difficult. So, and this is why it's what's happening right now. It's extraordinary dynamic, and it's not black and white. It may have been black and white a couple of years ago, but now it's definitely like gray. It's a scale of gray. But like the question of this alcohol and profile of wine and profile of palate, I think it's just a symptom of like an idea of how we decide to grow and farm, and a question of agriculture and viticulture, which is more about, do we want to produce something for a style of a market? So is it the stylistics, the final part? Or now do we realize that we are dealing with something that you may control, yet we should more observe and pay attention to? And in that case, at least for California, because it's still kind of an area where they are discovering so many soil and places to grow, observation, where is the best place to plant grapes, where is the best place to grow grape, if tomorrow we don't have any more irrigation, and if tomorrow the public doesn't like 15 or 16% wine, how maybe instead of looking at the very end, we should go and look at the very beginning and just observe where is the best terroir and biodiversity to grow plants and vine.
Yeah. Greg, well put. And that's kind of what's happening. To that end, I was able to, I don't know where I had my notes. I had them somewhere. But to that end, I was able to, one of the days we sat down with Ostertag and the guys from Just Meyer. We sat around with the organic guys. And I must say, in credit to the AOC in Alsace, they're really very friendly to organic bioproducers, more so than other AOCs.
They've been very dynamic, and they're very they have really iconic producers that very early on went in that path and showed that it was possible to grow organic, to grow biodynamic, yet to be recognized as some of the greatest growers in the area, and over time, you know, you're mentioning like Christophe at Just Meyer is one of them, Ostertag, but Olivier Zinnenbrecht is also one of them.
Yeah, that's who we were with. It was Olivier Humbrecht, Andre, that's who we were with. Yeah. The three guys, Olivier Humbrecht, Andre Ostertag, and Christophe.
Christophe. Yeah.
And before that, I was with Catherine Fowler of Weinbach, and I didn't realize they had been
in Bayonne,
since the 90s.
Yeah, it's been a long time for them. It's also probably because being closer to Germany, where Steiner and like a lot of bio, like organic movement have been stronger than in France, I think there is definitely an influence of that. And the climate of Alsace, if you think about northern area to grow grape, Alsace is a little bit more lucky, and it's a little bit less complicated to grow organic and biodynamic, just because there is a bit less rain influence than if you go towards, you know, the Loire, the coast, even Bordeaux. So combination of that and really believer close to nature, and you get these guys that are really strong and really big pioneer and exceptional winemaker. The quality of Alsatian wine right now is totally underrated.
Agreed. So, I mean, that's kind of why we were there, to tell that story. So, and for me, it was an eye opener because, you know, you're one of the great things you have with your job and Risto and all the Psalms all day long. I mean, we were walking in here today, and someone says, Pascaline, and it's Zev, who's sitting at a table, and Zev's an importer with a great bio portfolio.
Really good portfolio.
So Zev's outside with, I don't know who he's with, who his friends are, but, you know, there's a dozen bottles open on the table, and all day long you're tasting. For the rest of us, it's not so easy to do. So for these trips are great for me, because then I get to visit producers and taste. And one of the first days we were there, we were drinking... not old, but Riesling's back to the late 70s and 80s. Yeah. So just killer. Like, alive, like just super wines.
Riesling, huh? Riesling is fantastic. Yeah, and no, they are, like, you know, they've been making wine for centuries. The only thing with Alsace is, like you mentioned, it is went through that phase where it was more about varietals than about soil, and more about volumes than about quality, and more about... hiding with some residual sugar what should be dilution, and fortunately for us, really a couple of growers realized that 30-40 years ago and went back to a definition of sense of soil, lower yield, higher density of plantation. And the idea is that because when you look at all the appellation in France, Alsace is really the only one that are mentioning grape variety on the label.
The only one, correct. The only one where you're going to see. That's a great point. Another reason.
And you know the label.
Correct.
You know the varietals.
Right.
So what does that mean? It means that what drives the sale is the varietal. So if you want a Riesling, you need to take Riesling as a varietal. But as you know, if you grow a Riesling on a very warm site, which is a very like limestone-based soil versus a north exposure where you may have some quartz or other like volcanic-based soil, metamorphic-based soil, you're probably not going to have the same taste. So yeah. Riesling being a very polymorph grape takes so well this variation that your Riesling is not going to taste like the Riesling, the varietal basic Riesling. So you sell it, maybe not, if you don't educate. And you were in that problem in Alsace for a while. So the fact that they really work today on more and more people are refocusing on where it's grown and how it's grown is exceptional. The only problem is, like, it's complicated. There is a lot of vineyards. It's like, you think Burgundy is complicated, go to Alsace. Names are difficult to pronounce, and there are still a lot of people just swearing by the varietal.
So we stood in one, Schlumberger was the name of the producer.
Yeah.
Not a bio, but... we stood in one of their vineyards, and she pointed out three parcels, one to my left, that was southern, one to my left that was on the slope, and one to my back right. And these are three Grand Crus. I've got 51 mm-hmm. Grand Crus in Alsace. Yeah. And so she said, these three parcels are next to each other, but each one has a different soil typicity.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So we went and tasted. I said, you know what? Show me. So later that day, we went, and we were doing a tart flambé demo at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. I said, meet me at the restaurant and bring me these three Grand Crus. I want the same year, same everything. So it's a level playing field. And it was like three different wines.
Yeah. It is like it's always when people are talking about there is no translation of soil in a wine, you know, maybe not a direct mineral absorption from the roots, but the climate, the slight change of temperature, the slight exposition of sun varying beats, the pH, the water retention, you're going to get some different fruit. You're going to get different wine.
Yeah.
So
Olivier Humbach, we're having this picnic with he and Ostertag, and we're on the slopes of Rangen, which is one of his vineyards. It's super steep slope. And he said, Mike, we're sitting on this slope, and we're going to taste the wine in a minute, but there's a river at the bottom. There's a river, and that affects the microclimate for sure. It affects the temperature, it affects the humidity, it affects everything. And then, of course, we have different temperature changes because of the steepness of the slope. So when I'm blending my Riesling from the slope, I have a 2-degree pH swing from the top of the hill to the bottom, which is crazy. I mean, just on this one slope of, I don't know what it was, a quarter mile, a half a mile.
Yeah, it's pretty high.
Really pretty high. And, of course, diffness in the higher up we go, the less alcohol, the further down towards the river, I'm getting more fruit, I'm getting more alcohol. It's crazy, even within this one slope, the variation I'm getting.
I look in Burgundy, you know, like it's the same thing that what they did in Burgundy is very like it's kind of being under a microscope. But bottom of a slope, high top of a slope is village, and then you go to the premier cru, and in the middle is Grand Cru. So you know it's been observed, it's been forgotten, it's been observed, and now it's start to be understood a little bit more again, you know, and it's why Alsace today is probably producing some of the most interesting white wine. They are doing amazing Pinot. Pinot Noir. But yeah. Just the production is driven by white grapes, so you are more able to find white than red. But the quality of and the expression you can get from Alsace today
was crazy. And then, so part of this, another thing I learned was, so Riesling's a funny grape, as you said, polymorph in a sense. And also, it's a very slow grape to ferment, you know. If Chardonnay is a sprinter, Riesling's a long-distance runner. It's slow fermentation for sure. So in maybe half of the vineyards that we were visiting, they were fermenting in old, huge format oak barrels lined with that kind of... it's not oak, it's anyway, the barrels are huge, but they've got tartaric acid that forms on the inside.
Yeah, easy. Yeah.
So it's not so much contact with oak, but the fermentation was 4, 5, 6 months on gross lees.
Yeah, because especially if we are using natural yeast.
Yeah, natural yeast. These are the bio guys. This was Fowler, this was Ostertag. So, I mean, super slow fermentations.
You take your time, and it's also like it's depend on vintage, like you said, depend on pH. It's cold in Alsace during the winter, so the cellar are not necessarily really temperature controlled. And we are talking about guys also that have been farming in an incredible, like the quality of farming allows them to let the wine ferment its own way, you know, to have the bacterial and yeast population able to handle the juice without spoiling it. There is a confidence there. It's not an overnight thing. We are like they've been working since years. They've been recognized more recently, but they've been working since years.
Yeah, so many of these families. I was meeting the 11th, 12th, 13th generation of the family that had been on that land, on those parcels, slowly expanding. But I mean, that's going back to the 16th, 1700s. Yeah.
It's priceless history, and it makes a difference. Alsace should be way more considered, especially for the price of the wine, which I think are a bargain among the greatest white wine in the world today.
Agreed.
And they age very, very well. The incredible potential of aging of the Riesling, but also Pinot Gris. I'm less a fan of Muscat and Gewürztraminer because I just more not aromatically, it's a bit too intense. Yet when Muscat and Gewürztraminer are on the right side and they are able to like the winemaker is able to tame down the varietal, you just discover a phenolic, a textural compound of these two grapes that are phenomenal. It's one of the wine for sommelier, which are dream. You can almost just build a whole wine list just with Alsatian wine today. You can start with the sparkling, you can get the crémant, and then you can really have fun with all the style of the whites. You can have rosé, red, and dessert wine. You can do a whole list with that.
The only other grape I think that comes close would be something called Chenin Blanc.
Yeah. Yeah.
From your backyard.
From my backyard, yeah, with Riesling. Yeah. Yeah.
Another great unsung white. I mean, everyone talks Chardonnay, but I mean, Riesling to me, I mean, Paul Greco has been banging this drum for years, thank God, to promote that. But you with Chenin, I mean, you've helped me open my eyes. I mean, the expression of that grape is remarkable, what it can do, how many things it can be.
It's one of the rare grapes you can express and you can vinify in a different style depending on where you are and how you grow it, because there is the acid structure, there is a phenolic structure to be able to handle dry and sweet bubbles, long aging, oxidative, and so on and so on and so on. Maybe less known because the best results so far have been really limited to very few wine regions in the world where Riesling and Chard have been grown in a lot of different regions.
International.
So suddenly, you know, when you are exposed to only a couple of hundred winemakers versus thousand and thousand winemakers all over, like all across the world, it's normal that this grape is not as famous as it should be. But it's going to change. You know, we're working hard on it. So hopefully it's just... And Chenin was used for a long time. Even Chenin was replanted in California, by the way, but was used for blending with Colombard, you know, to make very high yield, like easy fruit forward.
In California?
Yeah, it was a lot of... Yeah, Chenin was a lot... planted a lot, but not on the right site. So it's come back to this thing. It's coming back to knowing how to plant, where to plant, and respecting a biodiversity and probably thinking in a more smarter way about what you can do. You know, it's not because you can technically do something that you should do it.
True that. True. So... this is a question I've been asking people, just like a theoretical, hypothetical. But it's not hypothetical. It's a real question that I'm sort of bumping into, and I'd love your opinion. We'll just step off to the side, away from Alsace for a minute, and away from the Loire, which we'll get back to. So my son, who you met when we were filming Rouge Tomate, he showed up and had dinner. And remember, he loved you. He's bugging me. We have to have dinner with Pascaline. I have a million questions. All right, we'll have dinner with Pascaline. So anyway, he's really into wine. So he moved to New York a year and a half ago.
Dude.
And he spends all of his disposable income at Flatiron. He's buying wines more expensive than I do. I'm like, what are you buying, Sean? It's crazy.
I hope he's sharing.
With me, a lot of them.
And with his girlfriend.
But she's not as into wine as we are. But... So when I see him, like, we'll have dinner once a week, and all we'll talk about is wine. Yeah. If I drive him home 2.5 hours, all we talk about is wine. So he'll bring the best bottle. So for Christmas, I haven't seen you in a while. For Christmas, he came home. He hadn't been home in a long time, and he brought 3 or 4 bottles that I love them all. And one of them, I had introduced him to Etna Bianco's when he was having dinner with me. Yeah. So Caricante's the grape. Mm-hmm. So he bought a pretty expensive bottle, almost $40, at Lou DiPaolo's store on Grand Street, mm-hmm. Enoteca DiPaolo. He went there looking for an Etna Bianco. The only one they had was a really high-end one. So it was... So we open it up. We're having 4 or 5 bottles of wine during the course of this meal at home. And this was one of the second or third. And he opens it up, and I pour it into the glass, and I'm looking at it, and it's almost... not exactly an orange wine, but it's been on the lees for a while. You could see it's got color. Okay. It's got something lees going on already. Swirl it, and oxidative style. I'm like, what the heck am I? What am I drinking here? What's the backstory of this wine? So that bottle's probably open for the course of an hour. We had a couple of bottles we were all working on at the same time, and of course it's changing within the glass to glass dramatically. So at the end of the meal, I go upstairs and I said, we got to find out about this wine. I'm completely, you know, it's really unusual style. So yeah, it's a small farmer on Etna, bio from day one, works the field with a mule, couple thousand cases is all he produces, but no sulfur, zero. No sulfur anywhere in the winemaking, not for stabilization at the end, mm-hmm. just doesn't use it. So I've asked this question to winemakers, most recently my friends in Alsace, about that. Because to me, I'm kind of on the fence. To me, there's like a purity to that. Okay, I mean, so it might exist naturally, but you don't want to add trace amounts for stability. But at the same time, if you're not adding, especially whites, if you're not adding teeny-weeny bit of a loud sulfur just to stabilize, what am I buying? If I buy a case, are there 12 bottles the same? Or if I buy a bottle and I go back to the store a month later and I buy another bottle, what am I getting? These two wines may be like left-handed, worlds apart. What's your take?
I work with a lot of wine made with no sulfur. I'm not a winemaker, so it's...
Right,
you know,
I know that. It's not fair.
Like, it's not fair. Like, I have a second hand. I am at the end of the end of the road with the people drinking them. The sulfur is a question that also, for me, is a symptom of happening in what we know in terms of what we add into wine, you know? So it's true that nothing added, nothing taken away... is something that we hear a lot. Sulfur being the one that people tend to think they know the, or they can talk about because it's a word and it's almost a notion that they, you know, it's common language. It's not like a molecule that you never heard of and you don't really master. I have a lot of respect for people that are deciding to work that way. You are a farmer and, you know, you decide to just to go this way knowing that maybe your production can go wrong. I have friends that lost wine this way.
They lost wine in the cork, let on. You open the wine, it's not drinkable.
Yeah, it's like it's there is a very high level of volatile acidity. There is instability in the wine. There is re-fermentation, you know. But they are going towards that thing and that ideal. So it's an ideal.
So Ostertag, the guys, I asked the guy, the bio team, three guys, and I love them all. I asked them the same question. And everyone, the answer was, it's a great dream. It's a great goal. It's a great aspiration, but as a winemaker that wants to deliver to me the best wine I can produce, I add a little tiny bit of sulfur below the step. I'm still allowed to call it organic and bio, but I know when I bottle my wine, I'm confident when it goes into a shipping container and it's shipped to around the world, I know what my consumer's getting.
Yeah, it's for stabilization. Yeah. The sulfur is not part in that case because sulfur is such a complicated story. You can add sulfur to so many parts of the winemaking.
Correct. You can spray it on the grape. You can spray it on the leaves.
You are spraying on the grape. The real non-sulfur winemaker, the real that no sulfur whatsoever, there is very few of them that are, some of them are like these guys are totally idealistic. They don't even spray sulfur on a grape to fight against mildew and oidium. Like, we are at that level of no sulfur whatsoever. So they are looking for alternative because sulfur is used at that moment against fungus.
Yeah.
Then you get sulfur before press. You can get sulfur to stop yeast and bacteria.
Right.
Then you get... So there is different use of that molecule, and there is different type of sulfur you can use too. So, yes, there is this idea of stabilization. I was lucky recently to spend some time with Pierre Auvernois in Jura. Was probably considered one of the most wise winemaker right now. He's in his late 80s and he's making no sulfur wine since 1986. Yet, what you take from him when you talk with him is how difficult and complicated, and it's linked to so many parameters of living organism that it's not an easy thing to do. It's really you are always walking on a rope, and you manage to do it because it's in a certain climate with certain grape, with certain pH, and so on and so on and so on. It's like I totally respect. I love this wine. I like this. I drink some of this wine. Some of them are. They don't manage to travel very well, but I don't know if I want some of my, you know, my unpasteurized milk to be taking over the Atlantic without being kept in a temperature control container. It's the same thing, you know.
Yeah.
What you need to respect is the desire behind it to show that with wine, more than probably anything in the world of food and beverage, wine has the ability to translate something very special. Which is very funny, like just to finish on that, but don't you think it's amazing that when you taste the juice of a wine, I don't know if you have done, have you done harvest? If you've done harvest, you know, you taste juice just off the press and it tastes like grape juice. It just tastes like grape juice. And it tastes like a grape juice from two different vineyards. You know, you can be very, it's going to taste, it's barely, sometimes you can barely recognize even the varietal. The only thing is amazing that fermentation, so the chemistry of fermentation reveals the soil and where it's from. So when there is a phenomenon that is so, it's not real alchemy, but it's close to that.
No, it's like alchemy. I say it's the same. It's like alchemy.
So
it's, like, it's magical to me.
There is something.
This juice, this sort of insipid, sweet juice that.
Through fermentation.
Through fermentation.
Is going to reveal something that.
Remarkable. And then even you get where am I getting forest floor? Where am I getting wet leaves? Where am I getting violet petals? Where am I getting truffles? Where am I. All the things that we describe in that nomenclature of off the nose, off the.
The texture, the structure, why is this tannic structure, and so on. Where does it?
Yeah.
So when you have this kind of very unique phenomenon and you can drink it and you can enjoy it, maybe you just more, instead of trying to desperately trying to control it, maybe you just walk along with it, you know, observe it and respect it. And I think this is a demarche, like for me, is what people doing low intervention, no additives, wine are into that, you know.
And they were talking about, so we were walking through his vineyard and Umbrecht was talking about, you know, he doesn't do green pruning. It's a less vigorous plant. It's not growing the way other plants are that have all sorts of chemicals in the soil that push. So he's letting the plants grow taller. He says when his grapes, because they terrace them high, he says you could see through his vineyards, and you can't in a lot of vineyards because of the density.
Density, a lot of nitrogen use for a lot of canopy management. It's just linked to so many way of thinking the farming. And one of the big thing I think it needs to be mentioned if you are talking especially about biodynamic, there is an idea behind biodynamic which is about biodiversity. Well, we are still probably in a pretty highly dominated monoculture industry where grapes just became ocean of vineyards. Linking to probably more disease, more difficulties to grow the right way, more clonal selection, and so on and so on. One thing, especially with people like Olivier or Christophe and a bunch of other people in Alsace, they are not necessarily certified, but you can think about the Biner, the Pierre Frick, the Schuller. Pierre Frick was a huge person influence on that. But they're thinking about biodiversity. And you just can't have vine. You need to have connection between other plants and insects and other vegetables to be able to farm the right way if you want to have a certain type of grape, of quality grape. So this is forgotten too. People don't talk enough about the ravage of monoculture in viticulture. But if you start, it's like what we are seeing in all the food industry, you know. If you have one clone of one species of one thing that is grown on hectares and hectares, at one point
the soil's dead. It's killing the land. Yeah. It's true. So we somehow managed without notes, without any formal pre-interview, 45 minutes gone, bang, done. We could do 45 more. So I can't wait to talk to you when you come back. If I can't get you on air, which I probably won't because I only have a few more shows, let's break some bread when you're back in California. I'd love to hear your takeaway.
I would love to,
Sounds like so much fun. And I'm doing a little something in Napa, like a boot camp thing in August. We're flying out there for just 4 or 5 days.
Yeah, so you're gonna have a blast.
I'm trying to open my head.
There are so many great things happening in Napa.
There are. Thanks so much, my guest.
Thanks so much for having me.
Pasolini Napatier, Master Sam. I can't say that enough. There's not that many of them, and it's so much bloody work. I have no idea how you do it. Congratulations on all that.
Drinking a lot.
No, studying a lot and learning a lot and having a great palate and a great brain. So next week, I don't know. I've got some great guests. I don't know who's on. I don't have my notes in front of me. But stay tuned. We have 3 more live shows before I take the summer off. Stay tuned for next week's Food Talk, and keep listening to Heritage Radio Network. If you have a few extra dollars, donate, because they need your money to keep shows like this on air. Be well. See you next week. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.